Enjoying Opera. Program 1. The Power of Opera.
Perhaps love is like a resting place, a shelter from the storm. It exists to give you comfort, it is there to keep you warm. And in those times of trouble, when you are most alone, the memory of love will bring you home.
One of today's great opera singers, Placido Domingo. Not, of course, singing opera. There'll be plenty of opportunity later on to hear Domingo singing opera and talking about it, too. But it could be songs like that, sung by opera stars, that give many people their first nudge in the direction of opera. The point of these programs is to give some idea of what to expect when you do go further and listen to operatic voices singing the music they normally sing. Today, the power of opera. What is it about opera that can seduce and overwhelm an audience? And why do so many people want to go back again and again? It can certainly, like all obsessions, turn people into terrible bores, at least to those who don't share the obsession. But opera itself really isn't boring, whatever else it might be. Opera can take us right out of ourselves, partly because of the emotional power of the music. On one level, it can be the perfect escapist entertainment. At the same time, it can be deeply moving, because the emotions in opera, even though sometimes extravagantly expressed, are emotions which we all share. But to begin with, how do people first come to opera? Maybe through hearing an opera star like Domingo singing popular songs. There's nothing new about opera stars singing other kinds of music. They've always done it. Partly because they enjoy doing it, but partly too because they think it might bring a wider audience into the opera house. Caruso sang the popular songs of his day. For many people, at one time, it was films, with people like Mario Lanza in stories which gave them excuses for operatic singing. But it wasn't only films that drew people to opera. There was radio. And of course, right from the beginning of the century, there were gramophone records.
I was at a boarding school and one of the staff was an opera nut, and he had this incredible collection of old acoustic records which he used to play with a thorn needle which he sharpened in a sort of a strop. So I was brought up on Galicorci and Tetrazzini and people like that.
John Cox, the opera producer and general administrator of Scottish Opera, whom we'll also be hearing more from in later programmes. He wasn't even born until long after this Galicorci record was made. She's singing the waltz song from Gounod's Romeo and Juliet, and it was records like this which gave John Cox a love of opera he's never lost. Opera is a little like a virus. You might catch it when you least expect to, even if you have an instinctive resistance. And there is resistance. Some people feel opera's exclusive and elitist. And it's true that opera was created first of all for the princely courts of Italy, just short of 400 years ago. Though even then, it didn't remain an exclusive entertainment for long, and in a very few years it was being given in commercial theatres as well. In Italy, opera has always appealed to people of all kinds, and this is becoming more and more the case now in Britain as well. For all that, it remains true that opera is expensive and it's always needed to be subsidised, if not by rich patrons, then by the state. In Britain, opera has only been publicly funded since the last war, and there is some truth in the accusation that private patrons in the past did tend to use the opera house as a social centre, a kind of extension of their own drawing rooms. They didn't feel that undivided attention was required of them, and they were very much given to chattering. Up to the end of the last century, house lights were kept up fully throughout the performance. It was only with the development of gas lighting that this changed. Partly, too, because a lot of people felt that the operas of composers like Wagner which have continuous music and aren't broken up into numbers, really need the full concentration of an audience sitting undistracted in the dark. It's certainly easier to concentrate in the dark, easier to be carried away, easier to dream. Vital elements in opera is simply escapism, fantasy, just as it is in the novel. It's one of the things you read novels for, something you go to drama for, to poetry, to the cinema. One of the greatest operatic artists of the 20th century was Maria Callas, and she once told an interviewer that for her too, this escapist element in opera was all important.
I feel music must calm the nerves, help us dream and see or hope to see a new lovely world, not our world. We don't care to see our world put on the stage. It's an illusion of a better world, and people love it. I do too, so why shouldn't we?
Yes.
Theatre is a fake anyway.
Callas tended to specialise in tragic heroines, but even for them, there are moments in which they can dream of happiness. Maria Callas as Verdi's Aida, yielding to the illusion of a better world as she tempts her lover to abandon his country and run away with her. Maybe, deep down, Aida doesn't expect to succeed. But what a dream. Yearning after a perfect happiness. That's something most of us at one time or another can't resist. But few people ever find themselves in so complicated and histrionic a situation as Aida. Slave to a princess in ancient Egypt, but actually a princess in disguise herself, daughter of the king of Ethiopia, Egypt's great enemy. And her lover? The leader of the Egyptian army. But if she can seduce him away from his military duties, she'll be in the happy position of, one, throwing off her shackles as a slave, two, winning the man she loves, and three, returning to her own country, which she's desperately homesick for, as its savior. Now, all this may seem very exotic and remote, but there are several almost archetypal dreams or fantasies embodied here. Dreams of liberation, of erotic fulfillment, of patriotic heroism. And of course, in a great operatic work like Aida, the emotional impact is constantly heightened and highlighted by the music. Success seems to be within reach for Aida as she and her lover sing passionately together. Maria Callas was joined there by Richard Tucker. Actors in any medium will tell you if you're going to indulge your dreams and fantasies, it's far better, and safer too, to indulge them on the stage rather than let them clutter and distort your real life. If you try to act them out in real life, you're inviting trouble. Now, opera singers live enveloped in wonderful, distracting music, but they have to recognize where fantasy ends and real life begins. Grace Bunbury, for example, who lets herself go with relish when she's playing a role on stage, tries to bang the stage door firmly shut behind her when she leaves the opera house.
In real life, you can't really be as dramatic as you would like to be, because you have to contend with other people. You have to contend with a husband and with opera managers and with reporters, you know. And you can't really do what you really want to do, whereas on stage you can. You can show all your emotions. You can cry and you can be temperamental and nobody bothers you about it. But if you do this sort of thing with your husband, you know, you will wind up a couple of months later maybe divorced, huh?
Grace Bunbury contending very successfully there with a reporter. Opera can provide an emotional outlet for audiences too. Vicky Romaine lives in New York. She's so devoted to opera that she gives up Saturday mornings unpaid to take people around the New York Metropolitan Opera House, which is where she spoke to us.
Some people say that it's close to being, to going to church. You tend to forget that there's New York, that New York is outside there beeping way at you, and the subways are just 500 feet away. And you can totally forget about your own life and go into a fantasy world. Because it is, it's living, you're listening to it, you're watching it, you're constantly being, all your senses are being touched while you're there. It's very special for that. Very special because it's a whole other world, and it's whatever you choose it want, you want what you want it to be. You're not responsible to the outside world, so thus it's a real fantasy. You can be the performers, you can be the heroine of the opera, you can be the hero of the opera, you can solve the problems of the world.
One heroine Vicky particularly likes to identify with is Leonora in Beethoven's opera Fidelio, and for very good reasons.
Fidelio is heroic, and I think in today's society we need to have heroes or heroines, and Lord knows we have a lot of crazy heroines in the opera, but she's a pretty good one, Leonora, and the music seems to support her so well because it becomes you, and you get into the music so much that the music becomes you. You become the music. You become Leonore. You become the hero. So you are the heroine for the duration of the opera.
Leonora's husband in Fidelio is a political prisoner, and this wonderful crazy heroine disguises herself as a young man and gets herself a job in the prison so she can rescue him. She does rescue him, and they are rapturously reunited. Helga Dernisch and John Vickers in the second act duet from Beethoven's Fidelio. Again, in one sense, a remote situation. But surely we have all had dreams of heroically rescuing a lover in distress or of being rescued ourselves, with the raptures of reunion to round it off at the end. Many children's stories have this very theme, a boy or girl swallowed by a wolf or captured by a witch, only to be rescued finally and reunited with mummy and daddy. And in the cinema, there's the archetypal Western. It's only at the very last moment, with the enemy already circling the apparently doomed wagon train, that cavalry bugles are heard and the enemy routed. In Fidelio, there actually are distant trumpets at the crucial moment to announce the arrival of the king's minister, and we know that all is well. So there are good and very basic reasons why opera has such an appeal for so many people.
Opera appeals because it touches on central human preoccupations. Themes like love and death and intermale rivalry, loyalty, jealousy. And rather like church litany, you can repeat the same words and same music over and over again, and the experience will grow. It has ritual aspects.
Glenn Wilson, a psychologist who's also a part-time professional singer.
The central, most emotive aspects of human experience are portrayed on the stage. Everybody recognizes in Mimi and Rodolfo their own passionate first love, for example. Carmen is the archetypal femme fatale. Pagliacci sort of typifies marital jealousy and so on. These are very central things that the most popular operas touch upon.
So, opera has the appeal of fantasy, it's escapism, there's lots to identify with, and you do the most amazing things by proxy. You're encouraged to go to the emotional limits while still sitting comfortably in a theatre or at home by the record player. But is the enjoyment of opera always such a comfortable pleasure? After all, bringing us face to face with the possibility of an almost superhuman fidelity and self-sacrifice, showing us the potential for tremendous infidelity and treachery, for villainy, for everything, every kind of passion, every kind of emotion, all this can be very disturbing. In life, reality, the conventions rather conveniently hold us back. But in opera, passions of all kinds are unbridled. As Dame Janet Baker explains, this is something the singers, just as much as the audiences, have to accept.
We're all alike. We're all totally alike in that we have the same raw material emotionally within us. Now, people who are drawing on that emotion for a stage character go within and discover those facets of the personality which will help them to discover all sides of the human condition, dark and light.
To carry conviction, the singer must also be an actor, as Janet Baker herself demonstrated whenever she appeared on the operatic stage. The raw material of the emotions portrayed on stage must be looked for and found within the performer, and then projected with conviction to the audience, if the audience itself is to be convinced. And yet experiencing these emotions, even the extreme emotions the rest of us may think we don't share, is not confined just to the people on stage.
I can't say positively enough how common this experience is to us all. The acting profession plays out on a stage the emotions that are within everybody. This is why there is this tremendous attraction for actors and actresses and singing actors and actresses, because people know perfectly well, if they will be honest with themselves, that what they are seeing on the stage are reflections of their own experience, which they may not have the opportunity, and with the greatest respect, they may not have the courage to accept in themselves. We have to do it. It's part of our duty, and it's not an easy part of the life to explore the human facets of oneself in order to portray a character with reality. But an audience, if it is honest, must realize that the great fascination for the play and for the opera lies in this very fact that they know that's their experience too.
Janet Baker singing Dido's farewell from Berlioz's opera The Trojans. Opera can often at first seem foreign and difficult to understand, but its appeal, nonetheless, can be immediate and direct. That, at any rate, is the view of the outstanding American baritone of his generation, Cheryl Milnes.
Music is primarily emotional, especially opera, and especially French-Italian opera, which I sing primarily. It's first of all emotional. It's second of all intellectual. And the human animal is an emotional creature. One of the problems is that people are set up, it's a preconditioned, well, that foreign language stuff, I don't know any of that things. Therefore, I can't, shouldn't be able to enjoy it. I think many people fall into that category. They don't give themselves a chance to let the wave of sound wash over. There is a certain excitement about volume by itself.
Is Il Trovatore.
Opera is, in my view, essentially a popular kind of thing. It can be understood in exactly the same way as Shakespeare was by his contemporaries. That was a popular thing. You didn't have to be a scholar to go to Shakespeare's plays or to enjoy them.
Lord Harwood, managing director of the English National Opera.
And in a sense, the business of kind of socket to them, which opera contains, that sheer physical enjoyment, is majority stuff, not minority stuff. I'm never worried at exposing people to opera here who haven't been a bit nervous about it, and they're kind of seduced because one invites them and says, oh, come on, you'll actually probably enjoy it if you enjoy theatre, if you like any kind of music, particularly things that are mildly loud. If you take them the right kind of thing with the right kind of person and don't have alienating factors inside it, they ought to enjoy it.
But surely a certain amount of preparation is necessary if we're really going to identify with the heroes and heroines on stage, with Ethiopian princesses or wives dressed up as young men rescuing their husbands from dungeons. Well, not really. The music carries us along, and it's possible, without too much difficulty, to enter into other times, other places, just as we do when watching a film or reading a novel. But as with everything, it may enhance our enjoyment if we do know a little about it. As with pop music, for example, most people go along to a concert knowing something about the singer already. probably knowing some of the music from records, even able to do a bit of a sing-along. And in opera, too, if you know the story, maybe know some of the music, yes, it can help. But if you go along and don't know anything, and if you've chosen the right opera, well, just sit back and enjoy it. Cheryl Milnes and Placido Domingo as the boys in Puccini's La Bohème, wallowing in misery because they've lost their girlfriends, but so mellifluously caught up in dreams of past happiness. And no reason why you shouldn't wallow along with them, like Cheryl Milnes' father.
My father, who was not a trained musician at all, sang by ear. Well, he was a very emotional man, and he would sometimes cry if I sang the C scale. So you can imagine where that put, if he went to opera, which, I mean, you think of any of the emotional pieces, Traviata, Bohème, the Puccini things, Tosca, Butterfly, Bach, I mean, they're fantastic. He would just cry from one end to the other.
Milnes' father isn't the only one who's emotional about opera. He also told us about his good friend, the film actor and comedian Tony Randall.
A very erudite, very well-listened, knowledgeable human being. Pure emotion. He'll go to a piece and he'll cry just right off the bat. In fact, my wife won't sit with him because he's a big elbow. Did you hear that? Whack with the elbow in the ribs. You know, you're going to end up as his partner with bruised ribs. So she always sits a seat away. Just, I mean, I'm not doing a number on comparing my father and Tony Randall in the slightest. But they share that raw emotional response. They're totally receptive to any kind of music and its emotional implications. That's where I think the lay public does themselves a disservice if they don't allow themselves to get hit by the power of opera.
The power of opera. Emotional power and physical power too. The very heart of opera for many is the sound of the human voice soaring thrillingly over the full orchestra, or, thrilling in another way, floating exquisitely. That's the theme we're taking up in the next program, which we're calling Voiceover.
Enjoying Opera was presented by Monty Haltrecht, and you can hear next week's program, Voiceover, at the same time, 4:10. Enjoying Opera is produced by Daniel Snowman, and the series consultant is Alan Blythe.